We just stood there for a couple of minutes until I heard a deep, rhythmic rumbling, one of those annoying loud bass stereos in some moron's car. The rumbling got louder, then there was a squealing of tires taking a tight turn, and Thomas pulled into the lot in a different white sports car than I'd seen him in the night before. The music got louder as he sped across the lot and parked his car diagonally across the lines I'd unconsciously respected when I'd parked. He killed the stereo and got out, a small cloud of smoke emerging with him. It wasn't cigarette smoke. "Paolo!" Thomas caroled. He wore tight blue jeans and a black t-shirt with a Buffy the Vampire Slayer logo. The laces to one of his combat boots were untied, and he carried a bottle of scotch in his hand. He pulled from it cheerfully and wove a drunken line to Ortega. Thomas offered out the bottle, his balance wobbling. "Have a swig?" Ortega slapped the bottle from Thomas's hand. It shattered on the ground. "Spoil sport?" Thomas slurred, wavering. "Hola, Harry! Hola, Susan!" He waved at us and all but fell down. "I was going to offer you some, too, but that plan's been blown all to hell now."
"Maybe another time," Susan said.
A blue light appeared in one of the tunnels from the stadium. A moment later, a vehicle somewhere between a compact car and a golf cart rolled into the parking lot, a whirling blue bubble light flashing on its roof. With the quiet hum of electric motors, it zipped over to us and stopped. Kincaid sat behind the steering wheel and nodded to the rear of the vehicle. "In. We're set up inside." We walked over to the security cart. Ortega started to get on, but I held up my hand to him. "Ladies first," I said quietly, and gave Susan my hand as she got on. I followed her. Ortega and Thomas followed. Thomas had put on a pair of headphones and was bobbing his chin in a vague fashion that was probably supposed to be in rhythm. Kincaid started up the cart and called over his shoulder, "Where's the old man?" "Gone," I said. I jerked a thumb at Susan. "Had to go to the bench." Kincaid looked from me to Susan and shrugged. "Nice bench." He drove us through several passages in the stadium, somehow finding his way despite the fact that no lights were on and I could barely see. Eventually, we rolled out onto the field from one of the bullpens. The stadium was dark, but for where three spotlights basted the pitcher's mound and first and third base in pools of light. Kincaid drove to the pitcher's mound, stopped, and said, "Everyone out." We did. Kincaid parked the cart over home plate, then padded through the shadows to the visiting team's dugout. "They're here," he said quietly. The archive emerged from the dugout, carrying a small, carved wooden box before her. She wore a dark dress with no frills or ruffles, and a gray cape held closed with a silver brooch. She was still little, still adorable, but something in her bearing left no illusions about the difference in her apparent age and her knowledge and capability. She walked to the pitcher's mound, not looking at anyone, her focus on the box she carried. She set it down very carefully and then lifted the lid from the top of the box and stepped back. A wave of nauseating cold flooded out when she opened the box. It went past me, through me. I was the only one there to react to it. Susan put her hand on my arm, kept her eyes on Ortega and Thomas, and asked, "Harry?" My last meal had been a drive-through taco on the way back from the meeting with Cassius, but it was trying to leave. I kept it down and forced the sickening cold away from me with an effort of will. The sensation lessened. "Fine," I said. "I'm fine." The archive looked up at me, child features solemn.
"You know what's inside the box?"
"I think so. I've never actually seen it."
"Seen what?"
Thomas asked. Instead of answering, the archive drew a small box out of her pocket. She opened the box and delicately plucked out an insect as long as her own fingers, a brown scorpion by its tail. She looked around to make sure she had everyone's attention. She did. Then she dropped the scorpion into the box. There was an instant, immediate sound, somewhere between a wildcat scream and the sizzle of bacon hitting a hot skillet. Something that looked vaguely like a cloud of ink in clear water floated up out of the box. It was about the size of a baby's head.
Dozens of shadowy tendrils held the scorpion, drawing it up into the air along with the inky cloud. Dark violet flickers of flame played over the insect's shell for all of 2 or 3 seconds, and then it simply crumbled, carapace falling away in flakes and dust. The cloudy mass rose up to a height of about 5 feet before the archive murmured a word. It stopped in place, bobbing gently, holding there.
"Damn,"
Thomas said. He took the earphones out. Music with many electric guitars sounded tinnily from them.
"And this is what?"
"Mordite," I said quietly. "Deathstone."
"Yes,"
the archive said. Ortega drew in a slow breath and nodded in understanding.
"Deathstone, huh?" Thomas said. "It sort of looks like someone spray-painted a soap bubble and gave it tentacles."
"It isn't a soap bubble," I said. "There's a solid piece inside. The energies it carries in it are what create that shroud effect around it." Thomas poked a finger at it.
"What does it do?"
I caught his wrist before he could touch it and pushed his hand away. "It kills, hence the name Deathstone, you half-wit."
"Oh," Thomas said, nodding with drunken sagacity. "It looked cool when it gacked that little thing, but so what? It's a bug zapper."
"If you disrespect this thing, it's going to get you killed," I said. "It would kill anything living, exactly the same way. Anything. It's not from our world."
"It's extraterrestrial?" asked Susan.
"You do not understand, Miss Rodriguez," Ortega said quietly. "Mordite is not from this galaxy or this universe. It is not of our reality."
I had reservations about Ortega's presence on the home team roster, but I nodded. "It's from outside. It's congealed anti-life. A chip of this stuff makes nuclear waste look like secondhand smoke. Being near it draws the life off you, bit by bit. If you touch it, it kills you. Period."
"Precisely,"
said the archive. She stepped forward to look at both Ortega and me.
"An enchantment binds the particle in place. It is also sensitive to applied will. The duelist will face each other, the Mordite between them. Will it toward your opponent. He, with the greatest force of will, controls the Mordite. The duel will end when it has devoured one of you."
Gulp, the archive continued.
"Seconds will observe from first and third bases facing their duelist's opponent. Mr. Kincaid will ensure that no undue interference is perpetrated by either second. I have instructed him to do so with extreme prejudice.